Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is bird artist and authority on North American birds, Jonathan Aldifer. And we're talking about this mammoth, amazing book he edited, National Geographic Complete Birds of North America, 3rd Edition. Jonathan, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this mammoth tome.
It is a large book, the Complete Birds of North America, yeah.
I've got to ask you about this because people have no clue, the general audience, of what it takes to edit a volume like this. And you've got to give the audience some clue because this is a complicated book.
Yeah, it covers well over 1,000 species of birds for North America, which is we define as north of Mexico, so the U.S. and Canada, basically. We started this book. This is the 3rd edition of the book. We the first edition was back in 2005, and we talked 25 very talented ornithologists and world-class birders into writing various family accounts and species accounts, and we brought that all together into a single volume. And I was the editor at the beginning. Now I have a co-editor in John Dunn, who is the co-author with me of the National Geographic Field Guide.
Now, did this grow out of the field guide? Because I'm an older birder. Uh-huh. And I certainly remember when that first National Geo Field Guide came out. It was big. It was bigger.
It was. And Peterson and the Golden Guide were the only ones that were really out there at that point. It was the early 80s when the Field Guide came out.
But it was amazing. People actually started sewing special pocket things so that they could carry the guide into the field. Now, looking at that guide now, you know, especially after Sibley and everything else, it was big, but it was only bigger than the guides that were available at that time.
That's right.
But this is no longer a guide.
Well, this isn't a guide. This is a reference book.
This is really a book for your table.
Yeah, absolutely. And if when you go out birding and you have a field guide, or maybe a lot of people, you know, who are experienced don't even carry a field guide, but you can come home and read some, you know, in-depth information about every species, including all the rarities and accidental.
Well, I mean, you have all the birds that showed up like once.
That's true. They're actually all in the field guide too, in very abbreviated form at the very end of the field guide. We started doing that, I think, 2 editions ago. We're now in the 7th edition of the field guide, so we try to keep it as up to date as possible.
How many artists are involved in this?
Well, originally, I think there were in the early 80s when the first came out, I think there were, you know, 7 or 8 artists. And I wasn't involved actually until the 3rd edition of the field guide, which was in mid 90s, I guess. I get overall there probably 15 people, because there are some people who just did a couple of birds. But we've actually updated the art quite extensively over the last 34. It's almost been 45 years, I guess. We've updated a lot of species. So some of them have dropped out. You'll see if you have a first edition and you see some species like for instance all the loons, we replaced because we thought they weren't really that. What we wanted as far as artistically and field marks. And, you know, the identification criteria are things that become more well-known and discovered over the years, so we wanted to make sure we included all of that information in the art as well.
Getting back to the technical aspects of putting on a guide like this, like I said, I'm always in awe of you people who do this.
Well,
laying out a page is a big deal. You know, you're cutting and pasting artwork. You're trying to offset it with the text. And especially in this case, there's a lot of text.
Yeah.
And then somebody, some new frickin' species shows up in North America and it throws out everything. You have to like rejigger the whole thing.
Well, that's why we set a cutoff date. It actually, since the book came out just last November. We set a cutoff date of 2019 because we needed a couple of years to prepare everything. We couldn't just, you're right. I mean, there have been species. I mean, there's now a bat falcon in Texas.
That's right. You know?
So we can't, you know, we had a definite cutoff date for species that we would include. But you're right. It's the task of organizing the pages and designing how they would flow was my job, because I'm a visual person. John Dunn is more of a writer. So I basically spent a couple of months with my copy machine and cutting and pasting, and I didn't do it digitally because there were, you know, I just felt it was easier to do it on a copy machine. I designed and laid out every page, and since designers, you then hand this over to a designer and a scan of it anyway, but you need to tell them the size of the birds too on the printed page, because that's important. We don't have exact scale of birds to each other, but we want the largest bird on a page, the biggest bird on a page, to be the bird that is actually in life, the largest bird as well. So I needed to position every image as well. And you know, designers sometimes would put birds into positions they would never be in, like flying into each other or something crazy like that. So I just took on the task of designing every page in the 752-page book.
Oh, my God. Now, do you have some artwork in this book, too, right?
I do indeed, yes, quite a bit, actually.
Tell me what species.
Well, I have some specialties. I did most of the hummingbirds. We replaced almost all of the hummingbirds.
Yep, I noticed that.
Yeah, and we put a lot of effort into that. I worked with another artist also, John Schmidt, on those, an artist from California. I've done a lot of the seabirds in the book, almost all the tube-nosed seabirds like petrels and albatrosses.
And people don't realize that, first of all, that's added. There's always going to be species coming up that are new for our area.
Yeah.
In that era. Pelagic birding just keeps cranking out new pterodroma.
I know. It's remarkable. I mean, one of the ones I was so just bowled over by was, I think it was like 3 years ago, maybe it was longer, there was a Tahiti petrel off of Cape Hatteras. I mean, nobody, you know, I think it was 2018, there were, you know, it was like, that's a South Pacific or Pacific Ocean species, and, you know, birds fly, and, you
well,
know,
especially
right now,
pelagic birds really fly. Yeah.
Yeah, but right now, you probably are aware of this, but in Maine, right 10 miles from my house, there's a Steller's sea eagle.
I know. I missed it in Massachusetts. It was only really here for a day, and I had to record. And so I missed it. So I haven't made – it's a huge, long trip for me. So I haven't made the trip up there yet. Not only that, the weather sounds like it's going to be crazy.
Well, it's going to be pretty rotten this weekend.
I want to mention, Steller's Sea Eagle is in your guide.
It is. It is, because it was a rarity in Alaska. And so it's been in the guide for a while. It's been in the field guide, and it's in Complete Birds, too. But this bird, this individual that is now in Maine, in Booth Bay Harbor, had an incredible journey, because it was in Denali in Alaska, and then it went down to Texas, right?
That's the jog I don't understand.
I don't get it either. I was saying, are we sure that's... But apparently people have looked at some of the details of individual feathers, you know, the patterning, and I guess there's a kind of indentation in one of the primary feathers that has showed up. It's photographed in Texas same way. And then it went up into Quebec and the Canadian Maritimes during the summer, disappeared for a while, and then, like you said, it came down to Massachusetts. Nobody saw it. It must have flown down the coast of Maine, but nobody saw it on the way down. But Yeah, I actually made the trip down to Massachusetts and did see it that one day. It was
even though it was
the
just
Taunton River.
That's right. That's exactly right.
I was afraid. You know, it's a bird I really am excited about and wanted to see. It was sort of a bucket list bird, and you know, I'd considered going up to Canada. But it was kind of iffy, and then it disappeared, so I never had a chance. And then there were travel restrictions into Canada also.
Yeah, that's right.
But, yeah, I've been lucky to see it.
I've decided I'm going to end up in Hokkaido in Japan in winter.
Well, that would be an amazing experience. That, you know, you see photographs of that with, you know, a dozen sea eagles on the ice with white-tailed eagles, and, yeah, it's pretty amazing.
The other problem with putting out a book like this is taxonomy.
Right.
Which taxonomy, for people who don't understand, explain taxonomy for a minute.
Well, taxonomy is the sequence of how birds are classified in, it goes from order to family to genus to species. So we've organized the book by families of birds, and there are like 95 families of birds in North America. And then within that, the sequence of species within a family depends on their relatedness to each other and their evolution. So the oldest birds, the oldest species evolved, are placed first. And, you know, you might remember in the early days, loons were in the field guides in the front, but it's been discovered that much more primitive birds are waterfowl, ducks and geese, and then birds we don't have in North America, like ostriches.
But people should know that every year, and by the way, this is determined now by DNA.
In general, that's correct. I mean, usually backed up by field observations,
right.
and song is very important as well, because that is something that birds pay attention to, and they separate out by song.
But in the old days, and I'm talking about in the 50s and 60s, taxonomy was thought to be a fairly fixed, well, we figured it out, and that's that. And then Sibley and, not David Sibley, but his father, developed
Alquist.
This process, and all of a sudden, every year now, it seems like taxonomy is rewritten.
Well, yeah, because, you know, they do this mitochondrial DNA, and it's a process to look at individual species and then sequence their DNA and then compare it to other close species, and some species, you know, particularly in the tropics, and they just don't have DNA samples, and they don't have the time and the money to sequence everything. So it does change, because more and more is being discovered every year.
Well, for me, the biggest thing that I'll still find hard to accept is that falcons are no longer with the hawks.
Right, although they've moved a little closer recently.
for a while they were after the woodpeckers.
Right. Well, they still are, but falcons are... Falcons are actually more closely related to parrots than most other families of birds. So that's kind of hard to fathom. But
well, especially if you grew up doing decades of birding and doing hawk watching, you know, you naturally counted all the falcons that went by.
Absolutely.
But and then there's another thing you have to deal with, and I want to hear your opinion about this.
Okay.
Splits and lumps.
Well, that also has to do with, you know, the taxonomy and the DNA analysis and the genome analysis. And, you know, I trust, you know, my co-author or co-editor on this book, John Dunn, is on the American Ornithologists Society's checklist committee. And that's the committee that really makes all of the decisions. There are probably a dozen ornithologists on that committee, and they look at this. They spend a lot of their life looking at the data that other scientists, other ornithologists have produced. So that's I trust their judgments. I mean, recently, I guess there's some bias that happens over the years. Recently, there have been more splits than lumps.
I lived through a lumping period.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, and it really seems like it's all splits now.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the classic one is Baltimore and Bullock's Oriole.
Oh, that's right.
Were considered separate species, and then they were Northern Oriole. They were lumped in Northern Oriole, and then they were split again, I don't know, maybe 15, 20 years ago now.
Yeah, Trails Flycatcher was the same thing, and now it's Trails, willow and alder.
That's right. And actually, it's been discovered that Bullock's and Baltimore Orioles aren't each other's closest relatives.
That's wild.
Yeah, yeah, they're not. Even though they occasionally hybridize in the Great Plains area.
Well, this brings up, as a field guide editor, this is another challenge, and you actually do this really well in this book, is to illustrate recognizable subspecies.
Right.
And one of the ones I wasn't even familiar with, black-throated blue warbler.
Uh-huh.
You illustrated the difference between, I think there was an Appalachian population that's different from the...
Yeah, I think it's Cairns Eye maybe or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's a darker subspecies. It's not dramatically different as in, you know, I think we have illustrated, for instance, at least half a dozen subspecies of red-tailed hawk.
Yeah,
which is a highly variable species across, you know, North America, and may actually end up having some splits come out of it, like Kreider's hawk.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Well, that used to be thought to be a separate species way back in the day.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's. I think the data that are being generated by researchers is much more reliable than the sort of data that was used in the early days of the taxonomy. Yeah. Was more like where they were looking at bone structure and things like that, and, you know, skeletal development, you know, in the 50s and 60s. And now we have really sophisticated DNA analysis, mitochondrial DNA.
One of the other really nice features of this book is there will be boxes within, you know, different families that point to difficult identification points. A case in point, telling a female red-winged blackbird versus a female tricolored blackbird.
Right.
And so there are boxes within this guide that sort of discuss those real serious field problems.
Yeah, we would have liked to have more, but then the book would have gotten up to 1,000 pages or 2 volumes or something.
Right. I was going to ask you about that. By the publisher, were you given a note like, do not exceed X number of pages?
Absolutely. I mean, we had to you know, lay down, so we have to have this many. I mean, we added, I don't know, I think from the field guide, which came out in 2017, to Complete Birds, I think we added 15 species. It was more than that because we added 15 species that aren't in the field guide, but from the field guide to the previous edition of Complete Birds, I think we added maybe 35 or 40 species.
Wow.
So we had a lot. We need more space. Well, they gave us some more pages, but, you know, it was a struggle. It was a back and forth. No, we need more. No, don't cut that.
Well, things like, it's really funny. When you look at parrots, I mean, originally our parrot species became extinct, but now parrots are breeding in a lot of different places.
Right, and the majority of them, the vast majority of them are exotics that have, you know, escaped cage birds or something. Like, you know, there's... red-crowned parrot in South Texas, I guess, is probably. And there have been, in the past, there were thick-billed parrots in Arizona and Mexico.
It's incredible how many escape species have now become viable species.
Yeah.
Like purple swamp hen in Florida is a good example of that.
Yeah, and its numbers are growing.
Yeah, it's alarming. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is bird artist and authority on North American birds, Jonathan Aldifer. And we've been talking about the book he edited, National Geographic Complete Birds of North America, 3rd edition. Jonathan, I want to talk to you about your artwork.
Yeah.
Talk to me about when you started, when did you realize that's what you wanted to do. You wanted to do art.
Well, yeah, it wasn't until I was in my, I guess it's when I, well, when I always wanted to be an artist. I went to Cooper Union. I don't know if you know that.
No.
Pretty well-known art school.
So wait a minute. What was your art like at that time? Were you?
Didn't include birds at all. It was, you know, it was based on landscape and kind of abstracted.
That's fascinating. Do you still have examples of that work?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah, I still do, and I really enjoy a lot of the contemporary art that has nothing to do with.
So how did you become natural history art? A renowned artist of birds?
Well, I moved in the 70s, mid 70s. My wife and I moved to California, Southern California, and Los Angeles, and by that time I was 25 or 6. I had developed a pretty passionate interest in birds, just as going out being a birder and identifying birds and looking at birds. But I got to know a number of other birders, including my co-editor, John Dunn.
Yeah.
We were all young guys back then. In Southern California, it was a very exciting time to be, you know, a birder. This was before the National Geographic Field Guide came out. One of the people I knew was Kimball Garrett, who is the...
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He is the collections manager at the L.A. County Museum of Natural History, and he and John Dunn were writing a column for the local Audubon Society newsletter called the Western Tanager. And they had an artist they were working with, and then their artist moved away. And Kimball knew I was a painter, an artist, and he said, Jonathan, what, you know, how come you haven't been painting birds? And I said, well, nobody asked me. So.
But that's not, whoa, Jonathan, that's not an easy thing to suddenly do.
No, it's not. And actually, I hope nobody can find and look at my early work in the Western Tanager newsletter, because it's pretty terrible. But I got good pretty fast, actually. I was always good at drawing.
Okay.
And drawing realistically. I learned that at an early age, and it's developed well at Cooper Union. And, I taught myself how to handle paint properly.
Now, what do you prefer for paint?
Well, I use transparent watercolor, and I also use gouache. Usually just not different colors of gouache. I sometimes mix it in with other colors, but white gouache that's used with other colors. That way you can pick out little feather details without... You know, transparent watercolor is to let the paper be the white. But for painting birds with intricate patterns, that's very difficult. So it's better to be able to go in and clean up those colors.
Well, it's interesting because I think painting birds, say for a field guide, is very different from painting birds for like a straight-on art project.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Because you've got to emphasize field marks.
Yeah, you do, my goal had always been that I wanted to paint a bird to look like I saw it through my good binoculars or a scope, you know, and so crisp and clean and not impressionistic, you know, but just what a really good look at a bird would look like, and put that onto a piece of paper.
But for a field guide, you also have to worry about it shrinking.
Yeah, you do. And I most of these paintings, and most of the other artists too, the paintings are usually painted reduced 50% from what the original is. So they're not huge paintings.
They're not huge paintings at all. No.
No, you don't want since they're going to be reduced, they're going to tighten up as they get reduced. And if you paint them quite large, it just takes a lot longer to put all those details in it. And then sometimes if you painted too many details, they get shrunk down, they just sort of disappear. So 50% reduction, so the birds are more or less twice as large as you see them in the field guide in the book.
We're almost completely out of time, but I want to ask you, what for you is the most difficult group of birds, family of birds, to paint?
Well, I've done some of the shorebirds, and I think shorebirds are very challenging.
They're challenging in the field.
Yeah, they're challenging in the field too, and their patterns are intricate. And I spent a lot of time. I painted the dowitchers in the field, for instance, and I spent a lot of time, and rejecting things that weren't quite right. And nowadays we paint in birds individually pretty much without overlap. That was not the case early on because they wanted to have a page designed by the artist. But now we use images in different places, so the birds don't overlap particularly.
So are you working from photos, or do you ever use museum specimens?
I use museum specimens and photos.
Okay.
And of course, nowadays, and I do my own photography too, and drawing.
That helps.
And it's difficult. I've worked on projects I worked on painted birds for the Birds of India, and I'd never been to India. I didn't do a lot of the birds in the big field guide that came out about 7 or 8 years ago.
Yeah.
But and I said, listen, they wanted me to do some work on it. I said, listen, the only ones I'm really interested in are the shorebirds, because they're the same. In most cases, they're the same genera, the same family, and I know those. If I don't know the individual species, at least I know what another Colidrus sandpiper is going to look
like. Right, or another Tringa.
Yeah, or another Tringa, exactly. So I felt pretty confident doing that. One thing that I wanted to say was I really think people need birders would be well served to pay more attention to feather topography. I don't know what you know that term so much, but it's how, it's the groups of feathers and how they're interrelated.
And know the names of them.
And know the names of them and know how they actually work, which is really important, because as a wing folds, for instance, different feathers get covered up and different feathers get exposed, and I constantly see people making mistakes. What's that sticking out? Is that the tail? Is that the wingtip?
Also, when you see a rarity and you need to do a write-up, it's really important to be able to describe whether it's the wing coverts or the tertials or whatever that you're seeing.
I don't know if you know the book. It hadn't get a lot of circulation, but John Dunn and I wrote a book called Birding Essentials back in the, 15 years ago. I wrote the chapter on...
Jonathan, we're gonna have to go. We're run out the clock. My guest tonight is bird artist and authority on North American birds, Jonathan Aldifer. We've been talking about the recent book that he edited, The Mammoth and Wonderful National Geographic Complete Birds of North America, 3rd edition. He also has a website you should check out. And Jonathan, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, Mark. It's been great to talk to you.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.